We have a long and remarkable list of strong, defiant, determined, smart, resilient women, Unitarian and Universalist, who were willing and eager to challenge the conventional norms of their 19th century world. Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Dorothea Dix, Lucy Stone, Margaret Fuller, Mary Livermore, Elizabeth Peabody, Antoinette Brown Blackwell, Olympia Brown, Lydia Mariah Child, Florence Nightingale, and Julia Ward Howe, to name but a few. These are our foremothers. They were educators, reformers, suffragettes, abolitionists, writers, physicians, and most of them were also wives, mothers, and grandmothers. So for this Mother's Day Sunday, I want to talk about Julia Ward Howe. But first, a disclaimer. When I was in divinity school, in my first preaching class, I was urged to own my biases because I was told that when I preached, they were not very subtle. So I have tried to take that good advice through the years. So I will now tell you that I am a great admirer of Julia Ward Howe, but not so much her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, despite his many accomplishments. So there. I've confessed. Julia Ward Howe is probably best remembered for having written the words to the rousing Civil War hymn, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and as the person most responsible for having founded the original Mother's Day, which, as she envisioned it, was to be celebrated as an international day of peace, which, in fact, it was for many years, and there is a Walk for Peace in Dorchester this morning. In addition, she was also a reformer, a poet, a playwright, a published author, abolitionist, suffragette, scholar, and a highly sought-after speaker. She was married to the educator Samuel Gridley Howe of the Perkins Institute, and by the time of her death, at age 91, she was affectionately referred to as the Queen of America. This is her story. She was born into a prominent and wealthy New York family in 1819. She is described as an affectionate and charming little girl and a high-strung and temperamental child with a temper. She was the fourth of seven children and considered the most difficult of all of her siblings, no doubt because she was very outspoken and also very smart. She learned to speak French before she learned to read. Sadly, her mother died in childbirth when she was only eight, and whether out of his own grief or because he thought it would be a good influence for his young family, after his wife's death, her father became a strict Calvinist. This conversion was not a welcome change for his family, who had been quite happy as low Episcopalians. Fortunately, once his wife's sister and new husband moved in to help care for the children, Julia's father was outnumbered and the family returned to New York society. However, Julia's father never relinquished his extreme protectiveness of her. And while he spared no expense in getting her the best tutors, he would not let her do just the normal kinds of kids' things, like go to other children's houses, homes to play, or even harder for her as she got older, go to the parties and dances that she so longed to be part of. He took her to the opera once, the Barber of Seville, and she was so enthralled by it that from then on he only took her to concerts. So in response to these restrictions, Julia threw herself into books, and she read everything. Shakespeare, Byron, Dante, as well as Balzac, Victor Hugo, George Sand, allowing, said her biographer, fiery, feverish dreams to fill her mind. At age 11, in an assignment for the finishing school she was attending, she wrote a collection of poetry, only to be criticized by her teacher for being too ambitious. 3 years later, she actually had a series of poems published in a New York magazine. So remember this word, ambition, for Julia Ward Howe. She was an excellent student, and naturally she wanted to have the same educational advantages that her brothers took for granted. And she also wanted the same freedoms they had to travel and be out in the world, but freedom for women in the 19th century did not exist. So Julia studied. To become an even more disciplined student, she would ask her sisters to tie her to her chair each morning so that she couldn't leave her desk. She learned languages, became fluent in German, French, Italian, and Greek. She also grew into an accomplished musician as a singer and pianist, and she dreamed dreams of being a writer. Her father was proud of her academic achievements, but he worried constantly about her complete lack of interest in housekeeping and domestic skills, interest she never did develop. You might think that having spent her early years chafing under her father's control, that she would have taken great care to ensure that she didn't replicate that situation when she married. But that wasn't to be. Soon after marrying Samuel Gridley Howe, she realized she had married a man who did indeed replicate the very same kinds of restrictions that her father had imposed on her whole life. One biographer says that Howe had a stern puritanical streak and was unbending in his belief that a woman's place was in the home exclusively and never in the public eye. As an aside, it seems that he also hated to be teased, and all of the Wards, but Julia especially, loved to tease. In fact, her siblings had given her the nickname of Jolly Jewel. To say that the two of them were not well suited for one another is an understatement. But the one characteristic they did share was that both of them, each of them, was extremely strong-willed. They first met when she toured the Perkins Institute with Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and as they walked the grounds of the school, Samuel Howe came galloping towards them on horseback. And Julia's first glimpse of her future husband was, as she said, quote, of a noble rider on a noble steed. Howe was handsome, dashing, fearless, and also a war hero for having fought in the Greek War of Independence against the Turks. And Julia was young and brilliant and beautiful. However, she knew, even then, that she wanted a literary career. And he knew that he wanted a traditional wife. And yet, they set aside their concerns, they overlooked their differences, as couples sometimes do, and acting on their strong attraction to one another, they did marry. While still on their extended European honeymoon, Julia wrote this poem. I feel my varied powers all depart with scarce a hope they may be born anew, and naught is left save one poor loving heart of what I was, and that may perish too. Samuel and Julia shared similar philosophies and in many ways were alike, especially in terms of their belief in reform efforts, but Samuel made it clear from the start that only he should actually work for reform and urged Julia to give up all thoughts of working and especially her ambitions to write. She never did, though she did have the children he hoped for. She had 6 children, and yet, ironically, today it's Julia more than her husband who is remembered as a reformer for her work as an abolitionist, a suffragette, and a pacifist. Having lost her own mother in childbirth, she had grown up with a lifetime fear of pregnancy and birth and was especially terrified in Rome on this extended honeymoon when their first baby was born. We can only imagine that being both pregnant and so far from home and having accepted that her husband would never be the soulmate she yearned for must have made those months in Italy a lonely and frightening time for her. But fortunately, their good friend from Boston, the Reverend Theodore Parker, happened to be in Rome. He was there on sabbatical, and just seeing him and getting to talk to him was an enormous comfort to her. Julia and Parker would become close soulmates through the years. She had a deep respect for him, and, quote, he thought she was the most poetic woman in the world. He encouraged her writing, and as Parker's biographer says of her, Julia's friends could scarcely forgive her perverse habit of attending Mr. Parker's Boston church. After the honeymoon, once back in Boston, Julia and Samuel's positions on the respectable pursuits for women became increasingly polarized. Without telling him, Julia wrote and then published a book of poetry, which unexpectedly was so well received, became so popular and widely read, that it was impossible to keep either the author or publication a secret. He was furious, and he felt betrayed and humiliated that she had continued writing against his express wishes she not do so, and even worse, had now published her book of poems. But in spite of his strong feelings, with this book, which was called Passion Flower, Julia's literary career was launched. Her husband accused her of writing poems that were embarrassingly tantalizing, but they must have been mild enough that Theodore Parker was able to read one of them in his Christmas sermon that year. Julia would not give up her writing, but, and this is interesting to know about her, she was not a radical, and she didn't want to be a radical. She wasn't a George Sand or even a Margaret Fuller. And it's true that she was ambitious and that she wanted a public life, but she also knew that at that time, that ambition was the antithesis of respectability for a woman, and she was not willing to sacrifice either her reputation or her family's. She was most definitely a woman before her time in that she really wanted it all. She wanted to defy the narrow and limited conventions that limited what women could do, but she also still very much wanted to maintain her respectable place in society. In a discouraging moment, she once wrote, "I have given up all else on earth to make one man happy, and yet have utterly failed to accomplish that." But still, she carried on. She was a responsible wife to her husband, despite what one writer described as having a hellish home life, and a good mother to her six children, and through it all, she continued to write, and eventually it was her writing that brought her fame. And ironically, her husband was the person who indirectly was responsible for her single most famous piece of writing. Having helped to start the Sanitary Commission during the Civil War, he was asked by the governor of Massachusetts to inspect the conditions of the troops. And Julia accompanied him on one of those trips to Washington and then joined him in an outing to Northern Virginia to attend a grand troop review along with hundreds of sightseers, if you can imagine. Unexpectedly, Confederate forces suddenly attacked, and everyone was forced to turn back to Washington in a massive horse and buggy traffic jam. And to pass the time, they sang army songs, including John Brown's Body. One of their traveling companions suggested that Julia might write new words for the old song. And that night, in the middle of the night, at the Willard Hotel, she woke up and she wrote the lyrics that we know today as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It was first published as a poem in the Atlantic Monthly and first sung in Framingham at a party honoring George Washington's birthday. Julia continued to write and publish poetry and travel logs, journals, fiction articles, plays, and even an occasional sermon. When she did preach in her own Unitarian church, she often preached on humanity's capacity for goodness and being a good transcendentalist, she believed that we are led to the divine not by dogma, but by the infallibility of moral instinct. We can take pride in noting it was Julia Ward Howe who organized the first ever women's preaching conference here in Boston. And eventually she became more popular as a speaker than she even had been as a writer, and devoted the last third of her life almost exclusively to working and speaking on behalf of peace and women's suffrage. Her biographer says that her broad learning, her earnest patriotism, and her social prominence brought the suffrage movement a respectability that it sorely needed. One prominent Bostonian told Julia's daughters that their mother's great importance to the cause was her ability to form a bridge between the world of society and the world of reform. So Julia had achieved her lifelong ambition to be recognized as a public figure and to have maintained a respectable position. As one writer said, times had changed. What wasn't possible in 1840 for women had become acceptable by 1900. She knew she would most likely not live to see women be given the vote, and she didn't, but she never stopped working for it. She was savvy and direct in her advocacy for women's rights. And once, in speaking before a group of society women who opposed suffrage, claiming the vote would place too great a burden on women, Julia said to them, and for these words alone, I love this woman, quote, "Many of the women who join us in petitioning for suffrage are women who earn their own living now, often supporting their families, including an aged father or an impecunious husband. They teach, write, sew, cook, do their own housework, care for their children, and they know they could find the little time required to give their vote. You ladies do not cook your dinner, nor do you make your own clothes, nor sweep and dust your mansions, nor sit at the weary desk of a teacher, and yet you have not time to vote. And because you have not, you with your delicate fingers would wring from the hard hand of labor its only guarantee of freedom." After her husband's death, she gave herself completely to the causes she supported, traveling literally from one end of the country to the other. And she was a good speaker. Apparently, she had a pleasing voice and a quick wit, and is described as able to address the needs of the day in an honest spirit of promise and hopefulness. When she spoke in Concord on the philosophy of Europe and America, no small topic, her talk drew over 1,500 people, the largest audience the town had ever seen, larger even than the audiences that came to hear Ralph Waldo Emerson. Although her great dream of convening an international peace conference never was realized, she wrote the Proclamation of Peace for the first Mother's Day held in 1870 to protest the carnage of war. I think of our reading this morning that talks about how with each step forward, we create something, and in doing so, co-create the world. And I think of Julia's life and work as expressions of that type of co-creation. By the end of the century, she was considered a national institution. She was, quote, hailed as the woman who wears upon her brow the triple crown of poet, scholar, and reformer. And at age 88, she was the first woman ever elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. I want to conclude the sermon by reading from the last paragraph of one of her biographies by Deborah Clifford Pickman. "Then in October came the last of Julia's three honorary degrees. To receive her last degree from Smith College, Julia, now 91, had agreed rather reluctantly to travel to Northampton, but once on the way, her high spirits returned. Golden autumn weather prevailed, and she was dressed in her white dress covered with a black gown. She placed her mortarboard over the proverbial white lace cap and was wheeled into the hall and lifted, wheelchair and all, onto the stage. Opposite the stage, a curving gallery of white-clad girls, some 2,000 of them, rose, and with them, the whole audience. They rose once more when Julia's name was called, last on the list of those honored, and as she came forward, the organ pealed out, and the great chorus joined their voices, singing, "My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." It was the last time she would hear those words sung. She died quietly at her home a week later. So we give thanks for her, for this woman, our foremother. May her spirit be with us, and may her legacy ever inspire us in the work we do for our world. So may it be.